We're holding on page 18 in Eirvin, or by you it might be instead labeled something else. But it's the middle of Osiyodzai in the last line of the page, Shom Tanya.
Yeah. Skips over from 6. From 10?
Yeah, they messed up the print. They messed up the page number.
Missing 170.
Yeah. Okay, so the Mishnah had mentioned, we're talking again, the subject of the Perek mainly is about Tchumen and the dinim of when you're, what happens if you're outside the Tchum and so forth. So it mentions that Rav Gamliel and a number of the Chachamim were once on a ship, and it was came Shabbos, and then some of them held that you're allowed to walk around the whole ship. It's considered like your Dalet Amos, and others were Machmir and walked only within 4 Amos on the ship. So then in that connection, the Gemara mentions that the Mishnah also mentions that one time they were getting close to the harbor and Rav Gamliel was able to tell them that they were within 2,000 Amos before Shabbos, and therefore that they were able to be Kodesh Shavis on land. They don't have to be stuck on board the ship and they don't have to stay within 4 Amos when they get out onto land. So the Gemara says, Tanya, Shveferas Hoysel of Rav Gamliel. Rav Gamliel had a tube, a looking tube, sort of like a telescope, except apparently it didn't have lenses. Show you Mabit with Sofabal, Paim Amabia Bosha. He was able to look and be able to see with it 2,000 Amos on dry land, or Knegdal, Paim Amabiyam, and correspondingly 2,000 Amos in the sea. So Rashi explains that the way this thing was made was Bechlal. When you look through a long, narrow tube, then the longer it is, the less you're going to be able to see at the other end, because your field of vision is narrower and you're not going to be able to see as far. And on the other hand, if it's shorter, you'll be able to see a greater distance. So he had it exactly calibrated so that you could be able to see 2,000 amos. So he'd know when there were 2,000 amos away from any given object. The Goyim bring a different explanation, which is that basically he used it with trigonometry. He'd put it up on a pole, tilting a little bit downward, and where it intersects with the ground, and he was able to do the calculations in his head to be able to figure out, knowing the height of the pole and knowing the angle and so on and so forth, and be able to calculate whether they're within 2,000 amos or not. There's a Yerushalmi, I think, that says something similar, that he had certain like towers and other landmarks like that, where you could use the same kind of thing in reverse. There you'd have the pole would be the known height of the tower, which the Gemara is going to talk about now, how if you don't know the height of a tower or a tree or whatever, how you can calculate it. So he would know in advance how tall, or he'd be able to figure out on the spot based on the shadows or whatever, how tall the tower is, and therefore be able to figure out depending on how large and on what angle he needs to point his tube at to see the top of it, then he'd know the distance. Similarly, the Gemara says, if a person wants to know how deep a particular valley is, maybe Shveferes, then he would take the same kind of tube like Rav Gamliel had. Umabit Babi Yabosha, he would look at it on the dry land. And he'll know how deep the valley is. Meaning, Rashi explains, what he does is like this. First, he calibrates it. So he figures out whether, in fact, he's going to be able to see 2,000 amos with it or some other distance, again, depending on the length of it and the circumference of it. Then what he does is he walks to the edge of the valley, uses the tube to sight the bottom of the valley. Then he starts moving backward until he gets to a point where he just can't see the bottom of it anymore. Now, by subtracting the distance that he walked backward, now again, he can use with trigonometry, he can figure out over there the actual depth of the valley. Anaf Yosef points out, now you would have to assume that we're talking about a valley that has fairly gently sloping walls. Otherwise, if it has like a steep drop off, like a Grand Canyon or something, then you're not going to be able to see the bottom anyhow, because it's going to be blocked by the walls of it. So it works for certain kinds of valleys anyway. Similarly, the Gemara says, well, right, so later come a govishal deco. Suppose you want to know how tall a particular palm tree is. And Rashi explains it's too tall. You don't want to actually climb up and measure it. Yimdod kaimasai, what you should do is measure your own height, vitsiloi, and your shadow, vitsel kaimasai, and the length of the shadow of the tree, viyeda kama govishal deco. And that way he'll know the height of the tree. Meaning, so if he finds, for example, if he himself is 6 feet tall and his shadow right now is 12 feet, then if he finds the tree's shadow is 24 feet, then he knows the tree is 12 feet and so forth. Similarly, if a person wants, he's building a grave to bury a relative of his, and they would put a pile of dirt on top of it. And he wants, he wants that wild animals should not take shade in the shade of the shade of that mound of dirt, because Rashi explains he's afraid that then the animal may smell the body under the dirt and go and dig it out. So what he should do is noyetz kona ba'arba shoris bayoyim. What he should do is stick a stick into the ground, a vertical stick, at 4 hours into the day. Now, 4 hours into the day, so you're talking around 10 o'clock in the morning, give or take. At that time, what happens is the sunny areas are starting to get hot. The shady areas are still cool. Rashi refers to a Gemara in Brachas that mentions the same thing. For example, when it says by the mon, b'chama shemesh v'nomos, that when the sun was getting hot, whatever mon was left over would melt. So that was at that time of day, dalad shoyis b'yoyim. So that would be the kind of time when wild animals are looking for shade. So check what direction the yira laheichan silay nota, see in what direction the shadow inclines at that time of the day in this particular area. Then what you do is make the mound of dirt on that side, make it on a slope on that side, so that since it's sloped, then it won't cast much of a shade. So therefore, some animals won't, so Rashi explains, in other words, other times of day, sure, it'll cast a shade in other directions, no problem. Other times of day, animals are not so driven to seek the shade. Later on in the day, even the shady areas are hot. At night, everything is cool, and so forth, or early in the morning and late in the evening, everything is cool. So it's dafka that time of day. As long as you make sure that the grave doesn't cast a shadow at that time, then you're good, and animals won't come near the place and then start digging up the grave. Okay. A couple of blocks later, it talks about the Mishnah mentions a concept. Anybody who goes out to save somebody, for example, you have Jews who are threatened by goyim, or there's a river flooding, or what have you, and Hatzalah people or whatever go to save them. So the Mishnah says, "Chozrin l'makoyman," they're allowed to return to their place. So the Gemara gets into a whole discussion. On the other hand, you have a braisa that implies that they only have 2,000 amos, and whereas the Mishnah is saying "Chozrin l'makoyman," which sounds like they can return home no matter how far it is. So in the course of the discussion, then comes this piece of here in Ein Yaakov. So Amar of Yehuda Amar Rav means shechozrin b'klei zaynon l'makoyim. The Mishnah is not talking about how far they can travel. It's true, they can only travel within 2,000 amos from where they are. If it happens that overlaps with the area they were in originally, then fine. Then that's considered as though they never left. But if not, then they just have a new 2,000 amos. What it means is, though, they can return to their place, to their headquarters. They can come there with their weapons. They don't have to leave their weapons behind. Kedetania, as we learn in a Braisa, but originally, when Jews would go, for example, to save fellow Jews from bandits or Goyish armies or whatever. So originally, the din was they would have to leave their weapons in the first house that they find outside the city wall. So before they even get into the city, instead of coming into the city with their weapons, they would be obligated to find the nearest Jewish house outside the city and drop off their weapons there. But one time their enemies realized that they're going in there to drop off their weapons, and their enemies started chasing them. So the Jews went in there into the armory to get their weapons. And the enemies pursued them into there. The Jews started panicking and pushing one against the other. Even more of them were killed in the crush from one another than the goyim killed among them. But at that point, the Chachamim made a takana, that they're allowed to return with their weapons back to their headquarters rather than having to leave them in a place like that outside the city walls where you could have this kind of problem in the future.
The Jews ended up being killed more than they would have.
So what we're saying is like this, the Goyim killed a certain number of them, but even more of them ended up being killed in the crush. By people panicking and then pushing against one another. Yeah.
Friendly fire.
Friendly fire, basically, yeah. Yeah, you have similar stories, by the way, in Gemara and in Shabbos. It mentions over there, we had this a few months back, that, for example, the Chum Meida Takana, you're not allowed to wear hobnailed sandals or hobnailed boots on Shabbos, because you had a similar kind of thing where Jews used to wear them, and one time they were hiding out from their enemies, and there was a panic. They thought their enemies had found them or whatever, and they started pushing one against another, and they killed each other, and many of them accidentally killed each other with these hobnailed, they're like cleats on shoes. So you're not allowed to wear cleats on Shabbos and Yom Tov, basically. Not so much because of Sakona, but because of Ma'isa Shahoya, because of the story that happened. So you have similar stories like that. Okay, so that's one answer. What it means is Choizrin L'Makoyman. So again, what the Mishnah is telling us is that they do have the limit of 2,000 amos still. So the Braisa is telling us they have a limit of 2,000 amos. The Mishnah is telling us Choizrin L'Makoyman, meaning they have within that 2,000 amos, though, they can take their weapons to someplace where it's safe rather than having to leave them in the first house that they come to when they're returning from their mission. Okay. So all that is one explanation.
That's because of carrying.
So what we're saying is it might have been an issue of carrying, it might have been whatever it is, but you're only not allowed to carry weapons on Shabbos, but in this case, because of the potential sakana, then the Chachamim allowed it. The Pashtus, maybe we're talking about where it's only an issue of caramelists, for example. Reb Nachman Yitzchok Amar Lo Kasha. Reb Nachman Yitzchok gives a different explanation. There's no contradiction. Kanshin Nitzchu Yisrael as Oyveihem. The first case is talking about the Braisa, when it says they only have 2,000 amos, is talking about where the Jews defeated their enemies. So now, having defeated them, then they can only go 2,000 amos, because now there's no more danger. There's no reason we should allow them to go further than that. Kanshin Nitzchu Ha'oyvim as Atzmon. The other case is talking about where the enemies defeated themselves, which is a nice euphemistic way of saying that they defeated the Jews. So now the Jews are in danger. Therefore, the Mishnah is saying that they can go as far as they need to in order to get out of the danger. So that's Choizrin L'Makoyman. So Nachman Yitzchok, in other words, is saying nothing to do with carrying their weapons, but it has to do with the first explanation. Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav was saying that they only have 2,000 amos, but they're allowed to carry their weapons. Reb Nachman Yitzchok is saying, depending on the circumstances, sometimes they have more than 2,000 amos as well. In fact, both things are accepted lahalacha. So they have, if it's a dangerous situation, they're able to go more than 2,000 amos, and also they're able to take their weapons with them wherever it's necessary till they can drop them off safely. So the Gemara continues in this connection. Amar of Yehuda Amar Rab, Oyvdei Kechavim Shetzoru Ala Yoris Yisrael. When goyim besiege Jewish cities, ein yotzin aleim b'klei zayin, you're not allowed to go and against them with weapons to fight them on Shabbos, as the Gemara is going to explain soon. Only when we're talking about they came out iske mammon, they only want money or goods or whatever. But ein machal in aleim as a Shabbos, and you can't be machal Shabbos for that. Just give them whatever they want, and that'll be that. Tanya Mihochi, we learn similarly in the Braisa, Obdim Khom Shatsarbuchola, but the Braisa continues, Bamed Varamamum Shabowal Iskin Momin. When is that talking about? Only if they came because they want money. So then you can't be Machal Shabbos to save your money. So then let them take whatever they want, and then they'll go away. Avil Boal Iskin Foshis, but if they're coming on matters of lives, if they actually want to conquer the city and kill people in it, then Yotzen Alein B'Klei Zayin, or Mechal Lan Alein Asa Shabbos, then we do go out and fight against them with weapons, and we are Mechal Shabbos for it. And the Gemara continues, and the Braisa continues, over Ira Smucha L'Sfar, when you have a city that's near the border of Eretz Yisrael, not even of Eretz Yisrael per se, as the Gemara is going to give an example now, the border between a Jewish settled area and a Goyish settled area. So then, even if they're not coming for lives and they're not even coming for money per se, El Al Iske Tevin Bakash, they're just coming because they want to plunder some straw or stubble, even then, Yotzen Alein B'Klei Zayin, or Mechal Alein as a Shabbos. Even then, you go with weapons and a Mechal Shabbos, because if they end up capturing the city, then they have now there's a breach in defenses of the country, of the Jewish area, and now it'll be much easier for them to go and attack other Jewish settlements. This is the basis for that Rebbe talked about all the years, Shleimus Haaretz. So that's based on this idea. You give away land to the Arabs and allow them to settle there. Then you have this problem over here of Ira Smucha L'Sfar. Similarly, also all the years that Rebbe talked about strengthening Crown Heights and other Jewish neighborhoods for the same reason, because otherwise you're allowing others to infiltrate, and it destroys the community. So all of that was based on this one little piece of Gemara over here. Omer Rav Yosef Aman Yumi, Omer Rav Nachman, or Bavel Keira Smucha L'Sfar Damya. So Bavel, for this purpose, is also considered like a city, near the border of the Targuma Nahauda. Specifically, they explain that that refers to the city of Nahauda in Bavel. So it doesn't mean the whole country of Bavel, but it means specifically the city of Nahauda, which Rashi explains you had on one side of it were Goyish cities, and on the other side of it were Jewish cities. So like Nahauda is like the bulwark that's holding back the Goyim from invading the Jewish area. Historically, in fact, there actually came a time not long, Reb Shuda Goin tells us in his Igeris, not long after a few years after Shmuel passed away, there were a nearby Goyish kingdom invaded and destroyed the city of Nahauda. And yet, for a while there, the other communities in Bavel were in great danger. So you can have one city like that. That's the key to the entire area. Interesting, worth mentioning, by the way, in this connection about this matter of going to war on Shabbos, you have the famous books of Chashmonaim, or books of Maccabees, as they're also called, that tell the background of the story, that tell much of the story of Hanukkah. They weren't written by the Chachamim necessarily. We don't know exactly who wrote them. They're not 100% accurate, but you know, to a certain extent, they're reliable information in them. Anyway, they tell that at one point you had a bunch of Jews, you had 1,000 Jews hiding out in a cave someplace in Midbar Yehuda, and the Goyim found them over there, and they gave them the choice: you either come out and surrender to us and agree to do whatever we tell you, or we're going to smoke you out and kill you. And all those Jews were killed on Mesidas Na'an and Mesidas Nefesh, Kiddush Hashem. So then afterwards, the story continues that Yehuda, the Chashmonaim, and his brothers heard what happened, and they said, "We can't do this anymore. We have to start going." And this was on Shabbos, I forgot to mention. So this was the Goyim caught up with them on Shabbos, and then Yehuda and his brothers say, "We can't do that anymore. We have to start fighting them on Shabbos." So what's the deal? Obviously, they're not changing the halacha, and it's not like these people in the cave didn't know the halacha. The vote is, Dodos HaRishonim explains, that the people in the cave, the 1,000 Jews in the cave, they figured if we had any chance of defeating these guys and saving ourselves, by all means, then we're required to do that. I'll be halacha. But realistically, we can't anyway, b'derech hateva, so therefore we might as well just allow ourselves to be killed, HaKadosh Hashem. Whereas Yehuda and company are saying, what we're going to do is we're going to start actually fighting a war. And once we're fighting a war, then the dinim of our Gemara and other Gemara supply that we can even proactively attack them on Shabbos when necessary and go out to Klei Zion and the whole 9 yards and do that. Anyway, so the Gemara continues in this vein, since we're talking about cities on the border and we're saying that when it's Shabbos, even though it's Al Iske Tevin Bakash, you still go to repulse the Goyim. So Dorash of Destoy Dimin Bir. My Dichtim, what does it mean? There's a positive Sefer Shmuel that describes during the time when David was on the run from Shaul. It says, Vayagidu l'David lemo, they informed David and told him, Hine plishtim nochamim b'ke'ila, behold, the plishtim are fighting against the city of Ke'ila, which was a Jewish city in the territory of Yehuda. Vehema shoysim asagronis. And they are pillaging, they're plundering the granaries where the Jews of Keilah have their grain or their straw or whatever stored. So Tana, we learn on a Braisa. Keilah iras smucha l'sfarhas. Keilah was an example of a city near the border. It was on the it's squarely in Eretz Yisrael, but it was on the border between the areas that were settled by the Plishtim and other areas that were settled by Jews. Vehem loy bo el al iske tevin v'kash. And the Plishtim are not coming to try to conquer the city. They're only coming to try and take straw and stubble. Because all it says is they're trying to plunder, implying they're not actually trying to conquer the city or anything. They just want to raid and get some straw for themselves. In fact, the Malbim on the Pasuk points out another interesting nuance as well. He says if it's said in the Pasuk, if it's said that the Plishtim are nochomim al ke'ila, then it would mean that they're fighting to try and conquer the city. Big Ke'ilah, he says, means that they're just fighting because they want to be able to raid something from the city. So they're only coming out, at least Ketev and Bakash. And the post continues, Vayishal David Bashem Lamer. David asked Hashem what to do. I asked the Urmatorman, Ha'elech the Kesi Baplishtim Ha'ela, should I go and strike against these Plishtim? Vayomer Hashem al David Lech the Kisa Baplishtim Vayishaita as Ke'ilah. And Hashem tells him through the Urmatorman, go fight against the Plishtim and you will save Ke'ilah. So you have to ask, My komibayalai, what exactly is David's question? Ilema ish shori I osir. Is he asking, is it mutter to fight against the plishtim or not? In other words, let's assume Rashi says it was actually on Shabbos. And so he's asking, should he go fight them on Shabbos? What do you mean? You don't ask that kind of thing to the Umbatumim. Hare Bastin shall Shmuel or Mosikayim. Shmuel Anovi was still alive. His Bastin is functioning. The place you go with Shilas and Halacha is to the Rav, to Shmuel, not to the Umbatumim. Rather, what he was doing, he was asking the Umatumim whether he's going to be successful. Dekanami, in fact, we see that from the wording. We say Hashem tells him through the Umatumim, go fight against the Plishtim and you will save Keila. In other words, the main thing he needs to know is he going to be successful? Is he going to beat them? So Rashi explains, in other words, that apparently it was on Shabbos. So it wasn't that he was asking a shaila. He knew the halacha that it's mutter, but he wanted to know, are they going to be successful? And he got the assurance that they will be. Tosfos says, you don't necessarily have to say that it was on Shabbos. It may well have been on weekday. But still, the fact that David has to ask the Umbatumim, should I go? And where, or not should I go? I know I have to go, but will I be successful? And the fact that the Pasuk calls it a mochama, nochomim b'keila, and that David went on Masiras Nefesh. In fact, we find in the Psukim over there, when David is ready to go, his men, the 600 men who were with him, were getting nervous. They were saying, look at this, even in Yehuda, we're in such danger, we're always on the run from Shaul, how much more so you want us to go to the Plishti front lines, and David winds up having to ask the Umatumim again, and again he gets the answer that you'll be successful. So we see there was Masiras Nefesh involved over here, so therefore we understand that it's something that you're mechal Shabbos for as well. So this bears out the point about even when they're coming al iske tevin v'kash, when it's in a city by the border. Okay. Further on, the next couple of blocks, the Gemara has a long discussion on the question of is there a rule that the halacha is always like Rabbi Yossi whenever he disagrees with one individual Tana, or is there no such rule? And the Gemara takes a lot of time, about a blot and a half, discussing all the ins and outs of it. So at one point, the Gemara brings the following braisa. Normally, we know that a koyin, of course, is not allowed to become tamei nes, and he's not even allowed, midrabanan, he's not supposed to go to Eretz Ha'amim, to the lands outside Eretz Yisrael, because those are tamei midrabanan. Nowadays, that's less of an issue, because we're all tamei nes anyhow, but the Mishnah says, or the Braisa says, omitame lisa isha v'lumot Torah, a koyin would be allowed to go in an area which is tamei midrabanan, for example, chutz la'aretz, or for example, a beis ha'pras, where a grave was plowed up, and there's concern that there might be fragments of bones scattered all over the field, and different other things like that. So he's allowed to go through such an area in order to learn to Lisa Isha, to go get married, the Luma Torah, or to go learn Torah. But Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Emasai, but Rabbi Yehuda says, when would that apply as far as the learning Torah? Bizmancha, and in Motzi Lumud, only if he can't find anybody locally to be able to learn by, then he's able to go to Chutz La'aretz, even though he's going to become Tomei Midrabam. Avol Motzi Lumud, but if he's able to find somebody in Eretz Yisrael to learn from, Lo Yitama, then he shouldn't become Tomei by going to Chutz La'aretz. But Rabbi Yossi, on the other hand, Rabbi Yossi says, no, af bizman shem motzei lilmud, even if he is able to find somebody that he can learn from in Eretz Yisrael, nami yitama, he still has a right to become tomei on a derabbanan level. Because a person doesn't necessarily have the source to learn from everybody. A person doesn't always have. Sometimes you have, Rashi explains, sometimes you have a Rebbe who has his teachings more clearly arranged and teaches Bederach Tzara, and you're going to learn a lot better by him than by somebody else. So it's like a Shidduch kind of. So Rabbi Yossi says, even if there are teachers of Torah available locally, you're still entitled, Koyin is still entitled to go to Chutz La'aretz. And V'omer Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Yossi gives an example. Ma'ase b'Yosef HaKoyen, Shaholachetzo Rabbi L'Tzidon L'Mod Torah. It happened with Yosef HaKoyen, who went to Tzidon, which is outside of Eretz Yisrael, to learn Torah. V'omer Rabbi Yochanan Halacha K'Rabbi Yossi. And Rabbi Yochanan says, the Halacha is like Rabbi Yossi. So that leads the Gemara into more of the discussion. So does that mean if there's a general rule that the Halacha is like Rabbi Yossi, then Rabbi Yochanan wouldn't need to say that? Does that mean there's no such general rule? And the Gemara goes on and discusses the ins and outs of it. This Yosef HaKoyen, by the way, is mentioned, but Pashtus is the same one, is mentioned in a number of other places in Shas and Midrashim that we learn a lot of things from things that he did. we find that he was exceptionally careful with the halachas of Tumah v'Tahara, which also bears out of it. He was saying that nevertheless, he went to Tzidon to learn Torah. For example, there's one where it says the Gemara in Zvachim, that says his wife passed away Erev Pesach, and he didn't want to go attend the Levaya, and then he'd become Tomei, he wouldn't be able to participate and bring the Korban Pesach, and the other Kohanim forced him to, because she's his wife, and she's one of the seven Krovim that a person has to be Metamei for. Another place tells in a Medrash that he needed to have his leg amputated. And you can imagine in those days without anesthesia and without anything, you know, you can imagine what it was like. Anyway, so the Medrash says he had his son was with him in the operating room while they're doing it. He tells the doctors, when you get to the point when you've almost finished cutting off the leg and you're like only attached still by a thread, then please tell me. So they tell him when he reaches that point, he turns to his son and says, please go out of here so you don't become Tomei from the Aver once it's separated from my body. And then the Chachamim praised him by using a Lashon HaPasuk from Kehelas, Yesh Tzadik Oyved B'Tzidkoi, which the Drosh on it, it's brought in Kehelas Rabbah. There can be a Tzadik like Yosef, where even when he's Oyved, even when he's lost, he's near death, nevertheless B'Tzidkoi, he still retains his Tzidkos. So we see there are a number of stories like that where we see that. So here we see. So therefore, Rabbi Yossi is bringing an example from him that if he did it, you can be sure it's the right thing to do. Okay. Near the end of the perek, it talks about the question. So we know you can make an Eruv Tchumen. There's two basic ways of doing it. You can make the normal way we're thinking of making an Eruv Tchumen is you put down some food at whatever spot you want, and that becomes your Mokum Shvisa, and then you have a radius of 2,000 amos in every direction from that. Here in the big city, we don't come across it very often, but when you're up in the country by bungalow colonies, then it becomes a more live issue. Anyway, the other way in principle is that you can go there before Shabbos begins and be standing there doing Bein HaShemoshes in the spot where you want to be Kohen HaShvisa, and that's considered your spot for Shabbos. And then again, you have your 2,000 amos in every direction from that. And afterwards, you return to your bungalow colony or whatever, which is within 2,000 amos. And then the next day, you're able to walk to that spot and then another 2,000 amos from there. So the Gemara discusses the question, which is the more primary way of making an Eruv Tchumen? And would it even be, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir are arguing, is it even allowed for a person, or so for a poor person, Rabbi Meir says, sure, you can do that. We can't afford mazon shtei sodas, enough for two meals worth to be able to put down over there in the middle of nowhere to be his Eruv Tchumen, then fine, he can be ma'ariv beragla, as it's called. But if he has food, then Rabbi Meir says he ought to be doing that rather than be ma'ariv beragla. So now, on the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda responds with the following story. Omer Rabbi Yehuda, Maise ba'anshe beis memel of anshe beis Gurun ba'aruma. It happened once with the people from the family of Memel and the family of Gurun in Aruma, which is the name of a place. There is actually, there is in Sefer Shoftim, it tells over there, you have the story of Abimelech ben Gideon, who was ruling in Shechem for a couple of years and was a tyrant and so on and so forth. At one point, it says after the people of Shechem rebelled against him and he fought a whole civil war against them, it says, Vayeshev Abimelech Boruma. So maybe that's the same Aruma as we're talking about over here. It's some town near Shechem, and according to that, it would be. Whatever the case, these people, during years of famine, they were giving out dried figs and then dried grapes, raisins to poor people during years of famine. So poor people from Kfar Shichin and Kfar Hananya, which are villages that are within 4,000 amos of Aruma, would come. They would stay by the Tchum, so they were about 4,000 amos away. So they would walk from their villages 2,000 amos until as far as they could, and then they would stay there until Shabbos begins, and that would be their spot. That would be their Mokum Shvisa, and then they'd go back home for Friday night. The next day, Shabbos morning, they could wake up early and walk to that spot, and then from there to Aruma to get the dried figs and the raisins and be able to eat. So we see, says Rabbi Yehuda, that even though these people were poor, they needed the extra food that the base Memel and base Gurin were supplying, but they weren't necessarily so poor that they didn't have two meals worth of food at home that they could have put down as an Eruv Tchumen. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda says, you see that even an Oshir, even a relatively rich person, is allowed to do that. They don't have to put an Eruv of food like Rabbi Meir was saying. Okay. Ketzed Ma'abrin Perek Chamishi. The main subject of this Perek is the Tchumen of cities. How do you determine where the Tchum of a city begins? So you have all the dinim about the shape of the city and what kind of buildings that are near the city count as extensions of it, and so on and so forth, and all kinds of dinim like that. So the Mishnah begins by saying, Ketzed Ma'abrin Esa'orin. How do we Ma'abrin the cities? So the Gemara starts by pointing out that there was a machloikas Rav and Shmuel, and actually further on, the Gemara traces it to a machloikas between Bnei Yehuda and Bnei Golil of what the wording in the Mishnah is. Is it ma'abrin with an ayin, which therefore is meloshin isha ubra, like a pregnant woman? So like the same way as a pregnant woman is larger than normal, the same way we're enlarging the city by saying that certain areas that are outside the built-up area are still considered part of the city. Or is it ma'abrin with an aleph, which would be meloshin aver, as in as if like you're adding limbs to the city? So which is it? So the Gemara mentioned the Machloikas Rav and Shmuel on that, whether it's supposed to be Ma'abrin with an Aleph or Ma'abrin with an Ayin. So since the Gemara mentions that, then the Gemara digresses to mention a couple of other Machloikas of theirs about the meanings of various Psukim. So one of them is Ma'oras Machpela. When the Ma'oras Machpela, why is it called that? Rav and Shmuel, so Rav and Shmuel argue why it was called that. One says it was two rooms, one inside the other. And you have the diagram here in Rashi to illustrate it. You have the entrance to the cave, and then you have an outer chamber and an inner chamber. Nowadays, of course, when you go to the Ma'oros Machpelah, it doesn't look anything like that, but that's because there's the building that was built over it, where they usually attribute that building to Hurdus, and that's above the ground over there. So whatever it is that's underground there is not visible to us anymore. Anyway, so that's one opinion. So therefore, it's called Machpelah Meloshin double. V'chadam Abayis V'aliyah Gabav. The other opinion says it was a lower floor and then an upper floor above it. So the Gemara asks, Bishleim Alamanda Oma Beis Batim Zau Gabzeh. Well, if it was two floors, one on top of the other, Hanuchdiv Machpelah. Then that explains why we're calling it Machpelah. Means it's double. But if it's only two rooms, one further back from the other, then my machpelah. Then why would that be called machpelah? That doesn't, that the lashon kfula doubled doesn't really suggest that kind of layout. And the answer is kfula bezugas. That opinion would say that it was doubled as far as pairs, because pairs of husband and wife were buried over there. Avram and Adam and Chava, Avram and Sarah, and so forth. So Marsha discusses over here that the Ramban Bechlal argues with Rashi over there and says that after all, the Pasuk calls the area Machpelah, implying that Machpelah is not the name of the cave, but rather the name of the area. And then the Mizrahi then in turn argues with the Ramban on that. He brings from the Zohar that says that it was in fact, like it says over here, one cave within another one, but there's a secret in it about the why it's called doubled, because it has to do with Olam HaSel Yonim and whatever. And Marsha says, so the essentially they're not really arguing, says Marsha, about the real meaning of the word Machpelah. Each one of them had a Kabbalah of how the cave was arranged, and we're just saying that then how does that fit with the name Machpelah, but not really the Darshan of the name Machpelah per se. There was actually a Sicha where the Rebbe talks about, there's a couple of Sichas, one of them, I think in Chel K, where the Rebbe talks about what the deeper idea behind saying that Zeh Lefnim Mizeh or Zeh Al Gabi Zeh. And then the Rebbe talks about it has to do with two levels of Tshuva, Tshuva Tata and Tshuva Ilah, like in today's Tanya. So therefore, is it that one is further in than the other, more pnimiyistic, or is it more that one is above the other? So that would reflect the two opinions over here. Then there's a Sifah in Chelik Tes Zayin, where the Rebbe points out that you have a number of machlokas and of Rav and Shmuel, including a couple more that we're going to discuss over here, where it comes out, the essential underlying machlokas is that Rav tends to look at the meaning of the word itself in isolation, whereas Shmuel looks at the context around it. So Rav says, look, the word Machpelah means double. Therefore, that implies that it should be something double in layout, one on top of the other. Whereas Shmuel would say that's true. On the other hand, though, you have to consider, if you look at the context in the Pesukim over there, when Avraham is asking Ephron to sell him the place, So Rav is saying Shekfula Bezugos, that it has pairs of people buried over there. So that works as far as the word Machpelah itself, but it doesn't really work when he's asking Ephron to sell it to him so that he can bury Sarah over there, Why is it important to know that there that's meant to be for pairs of people to be buried over there? Therefore, it fits better to say that it means the actual layout of the cave itself, which that's something that Ephraim could recognize. So it's an example of looking at the word itself versus looking at the context. There was an interesting point that one of the Mefarshim says also, that you find a Gemara in Baba Basra that describes the kind of burial caves that they had in those days, where you'd have a more or less rectangular cave, and then you'd have niches cut into the walls around it, and you'd put the mason into the niches around the walls over there. And the Gemara describes over there a layout where you have a cave with eight spaces around it, exactly fitting the fact that Aras Machpela has space for eight people. Speaking of the Ma'aras Machpelah, so it was in Chevron, which is also called Kiryas Arba. So, and the Pasuk at one point mentions Mamre Kiryas Ho Arba. So it calls it Mamre, the city of the four. So now Ma'ashar explains, in earlier Pesukim, when it calls it Kiryas Arba, you could say it means the city of Arba. You find in Midrashim that you have in Pesukim, it mentions the three giants over there, Achimon, Sheshai, and Talmai. And there are Midrashim that explain, based on this word Arba, that was the name of their father. Their father was named Arba, and then he had these three giant sons. But here where it says Mamre Kiryas Ho Arba, you don't find a hey before a proper name. You never say, for example, Ha Ruven or Ha Moshe or whatever. So therefore, now the Gemara needs to understand that the word Arba is actually a number. So in that case, why is it called Kiryas Arba? It's called Kiryas Arba Zogus, because it means the city where four pairs are buried, where four couples are buried. Adam Machava, Avraham, Sara, Yitzchak, Rivka, Yaakov, Aleihem. So in token of that, it's called Kiryas Arba. As far as Mamre, that would be the name of the city, or it would be the name of the, or it would be the name of the valley, or whatever. Actually, this point about the eight kvarim, actually, Marsha mentioned that over here, since based on that Gemara and Baba Basra about the eight kvarim, the eight niches, then therefore that's why Davka, the Maris Machpelah, was arranged in that way. Okay, another Machlokas Rav and Shmuel in the same vein, when it says by Hibimei Amroth, By the war of the four kings. So Rav and Shmuel argue here he's called Amraphel, but we also know that he's called Nimrod. So which one was his real name and which one is a nickname? So Chad Omer Nimrod Shmoy Velominik Shmoy Amraphel, Sha'omar Vihipel, Savram Abin, Vasach Kivshan Esh. He says that he's called Amraphel because he ordered that Avraham should be thrown into the fiery furnace. V'chadam Amraphel, Shmoy, the other says his basic name is Amraphel, V'lomenek Shmoy Nimrod, so why is he nicknamed Nimrod? Shehimrod is kol olam kulam, Machose Olav, because he made the entire world rebel against Hashem. First of all, Marsha points out, now this war, the four kings against the five in Lech Lecha, is the first war ever recorded in Tanakh, and the Medrash says it was actually the first war ever. So therefore, we have to assume that a loy bar kosev listim el lefarish, the pasuk, if there were wars before that, then the Torah would have told us of them. So therefore we have to assume the Gemara is assuming that Amraphel, who started the war over there, and he's listed first, must have been a well-known Rasha to start such a terrible thing in human society, war, and therefore the Gemara identifies him with Nimrod, and the only question is what the real name is. Again, in that same Sicha, in Chelek Tes Zayin, that ever talks about the idea, again, you have the same question. So in Parashas Noyach, when it lists the sons of Cush, so it says, Chush Yolanus Nimrod. So look, if you look at the word itself, you would say the same way as it mentions all the other sons of Cush. And why was one of them called? Svan, another one Chavila, and so forth. That's how he decided to name them. So there's another one who decided to name him Nimrod. That name doesn't itself have any particular meaning. Later on, though, if the Torah is reintroducing him as Amraphel, then it must mean that that's something special, and it tells us about his rishus about trying to kill Avram. On the other hand, the other opinion says, look at the context over there. The Torah doesn't just say that Cush Yolanus Nimrod. It goes on to describe who are your Gibbert Said Ba'aretz, and so on and so forth. So therefore, that suggests more that the name Nimrod is not really his actual name, but rather tells us what he was trying to accomplish. Shehimrod is Kol Olam, and therefore we would have to say that Amraphel was just his personal name, and therefore later on, when the Torah is introducing him with the other kings, then it just mentions him by his personal name. So again, this kind of thing of the word itself versus the surrounding context. And we'll continue tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem. Yom Yom Mashiach Ge'ola, Yud Gimel Tammuz. In the time of the Beis Mikdash, all the Jewish people were in one place in Eretz Yisrael. And from there, the light of Torah spread out to the whole world, milamayla lamata. So the purpose was to make a dira, lo yisparach, the way it'll be in the complete dira that will be lost in love. Then comes the time of Golus, and the Jewish people are scattered all over the place. And the idea is, again, in order to be mevara of the world in every place, now we're doing the avodas habirur and mimata lamayla. But all of that was still only in the Chatzi Kadir Elyon, only in the upper half of the globe, which is centered on Eretz Yisrael, because that's where Matan Torah took place. There's a letter where the Rebbe asked the Friedrich Rebbe about that, that what does it mean that it says in Chassidus that there was no Matan Torah in Chatzi Kadir Atachton, and the Friedrich Rebbe says, yeah, that's what it was. So then, now we come closer to the Gola, large numbers of Jews have come to the Chatzi Kadir Atachton, which is where we are, in order to refine this part of the world as well. Halacha, continuing on Dorim and Shavuos. We were talking about that a person shouldn't make a neder, and even for tzedakah, better to say bli neder, etc. If a person wants to set himself up a certain zman for learning or to do a certain mitzvah, and he's concerned that he may get careless or that his yetzer hara may get the better of him to do a certain isser or prevent him from doing a mitzvah, then he is allowed to encourage himself with a neder or shvua. There you have, it says in the Gemara, Nishbat, it brings from the pasuk Nishbati, Rakayema, Lishma, Mishpatei Tzedakah. So there, in fact, even if the person doesn't use a loshen of neder or shvua, he just says it verbally, then it becomes a neder. The Gemara gives an expression, for example, that a person says to somebody else, Nashkim, Nishna, Perek, then that's considered a neder gadol. So therefore, when a person is getting ready to do a mitzvah, better he should say bli neder, and even when he's doing a dvar reshus, so that he doesn't end up getting tripped up on the neder. But where he needs to, as we're saying, because otherwise his yetzer hara may get the better of him, then he would be allowed to say a losh of something that actually constitutes a neder or shvua, as the case may be.